Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. From the front page, DNA was proof needed to solve decades-old ID theft. UI's detective's challenge was to determine who was telling the truth by Trish Mahaffey, the Gazette. One man seemed credible and one didn't, but a police detective knew that there was more to the story, which is usually the case by the time police get involved. University of Iowa Police Detective Ian Mallory had two men claiming to be victim of identity theft. Matthew David Kearns, 58, of Heartland, Wisconsin, and William Donald Woods, 55, of California. One was a UI hospital's IT systems lead. The other was a homeless man in California who may have been suffering from mental health issues. Both claimed to be William Donald Woods. Both acknowledged the other, and either could have been him, Mallory told Gazette last week. His challenge was to unravel the complicated identity theft scheme that spanned three decades. Contrary to CSI television shows, criminal investigations aren't solved in an hour, Mallory said. It took him about a year of research. This case of stolen identity began in 1988 when a man with the UI job, who turned out to be Kieran's, had worked with Woods, the homeless man, at a hot dog cart in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mallory had to comb through hundreds of police and government documents from Wisconsin, California, Idaho, Colorado, Oregon, Kentucky, and Iowa to investigate both men's backgrounds and criminal histories. Mallory, 44, who received an award Monday for his work from the U.S. Attorney's Office, which ultimately prosecuted the case, said investigative work is like peeling back layers upon layers of an onion and finding the hows and whys. There are many points in the investigation when Mallory hit a brick wall and thought, this can't be right. He would then turn to his co-workers for help and advice when he found something and knew, no way, this is real. The investigation showed Kearns took over Woods' life, stealing his identity to acquire loans, credit, and jobs, and even had a son under Woods' name. When the real Woods discovered someone was racking up $130 in debt under his name, he reported it to bank officials and wanted to close his account, but it resulted in Woods being arrested in 2019 and convicted in 2021, serving 428 days in jail and 147 days in a mental hospital. Woods pleaded no contest in exchange for time served and was released, but a judge ordered him to go by his true name, Matthew Kearns. Over the years, Woods made numerous attempts to regain his identity, even contacting local police where Kearns was living in Heartland, Wisconsin, but Kearns again reported he was the real Woods and the victim of identity fraud. What to believe? In January 2023, when Woods learned Kearns was working remotely from Wisconsin for UI Hospitals in the Information Technology Department, earning more than $100,000 a year, he reported Kearns to the hospital's security department, and his complaint was referred to the UI Police Department. Mallory admitted he didn't know what to believe, but the facts of the case don't lie, and he couldn't dismiss anything, especially a victim who had been completely wronged, wrongfully accused and prosecuted, and ordered by a judge to live under another name. Mallory said his supervisors let me be me, having a knack for digging into cases. He started working on the case in February 2023 and chipped away at it when he had time. Mallory said results started materializing in May and June 2023, and he held the final key to the truth. Two buccal swabs containing DNA. He obtained DNA from Woods' father in March and then from the homeless Woods in May 2023. The results proved Woods was who he had been telling bank, police, court, and other government officials for 35 years. Mallory said it wasn't difficult getting Woods' DNA sample because Woods said he would do anything to be vindicated. He encouraged Woods, who was living homeless on the streets, to go into the Santa Monica Police Department and let them collect the evidence. Mallory had set it up with an investigator. I needed him to trust them so we could get this proof, Mallory said. Woods did cooperate. After the results were back, Mallory went back for his second interview with Kearns in July 2023. Mallory asked Kieran's his father's name, and Kieran's accidentally gave the first name of his own adoptive father. Mallory then told Kieran's the results of the DNA evidence, and Kieran said, "My life is over and everything is gone." Kieran's admitted that he had used Ancestry.com in 2012 to obtain Woods' birth certificate. Kieran's pleaded earlier this month to one count each of false statement to a credit union and aggravated identity theft. He faces up to 32 years in federal prison. Unexpected award. The exemplary work by Mallory, a UI detective for 8 years, was honored with the Law Enforcement Victim Service Award. Detective Mallory did not dismiss Woods' seemingly fantastic claims out of hand and instead spent the ensuing months unraveling Kieran's identity theft scheme, Assistant U.S. Attorney Tim Vavrichek said in his nomination letter. Through his open-mindedness, patience, and diligence, Detective Mallory was able to successfully unravel a sophisticated 3-decade-old fraud that had fooled other police officers, courts, banks, and government officials. Mallory, through his persistence, not only helped protect Woods from further victimization by Kieran's, but he also protected UI Hospital's information systems from being guarded by a prolific identity thief, Vavrichek noted in his letter. Johnson County Attorney Rachel Zimmerman Smith, during the ceremony, said it was no surprise that Mallory broke open this case because any time he has brought her a case, it is always well investigated and well presented. It is a well-deserved honor. U.S. Attorney Tim Dow, who presented the award to Mallory, said this was the best investigation work he's seen in his more than 30 years as a prosecutor. Mallory treated the victim with dignity and respect, Dow said. He also pointed out that Mallory was able to get DNA evidence, which isn't easy and usually expensive. Mallory spent 6 hours interviewing Kieran's and got a confession. Mallory, during the ceremony, thanked those in attendance and gave a special thanks to Vavrichek for seeing the case for what it was when many others didn't. He also thanked his wife for many conversations and discussions about Woods and Kieran's. His parents, aunt and uncle, and his work family also attended the event Monday. Mallory said he couldn't have closed this case without others in the UI investigation division who were key in helping him when he was stuck on the case and the forensic tech. The UI has been a fantastic department to work for, Mallory said. I love what I do and have a blast at work. This job brings both my life of technology and police work together. I hope this award shows others that you can't take the first story at face value and never be dismissive of someone just because they're homeless and may suffer from mental health issues, Mallory said. No one believed me. Woods' account of events was all over the place, but the factual documents and data points showed he was telling the truth, he said. As soon as Kieran's was in custody, Mallory said he called Woods and told him. Woods said, "Cool, I told you so. No one believed me." Mallory has never met Woods in person. After the federal prosecutors took the case, they flew Woods to Cedar Rapids to testify before a grand jury to indict Kieran's, but Mallory was out of town and missed him. Woods didn't like the cold weather and didn't want to stay long in Iowa, Mallory said. Mallory said UI police are no longer involved in the case. He speculated it may be going on for several years in other states where Kieran's lived. UI seeks 10% budget hike for new burn treatment center. UIHC wants Region OK amid recent boom in construction, by Vanessa Miller, The Gazette, Iowa City. Among over $2 billion in upcoming University of Iowa healthcare construction, including a $1 billion inpatient tower near Kinnick Stadium, is an expected burn treatment center, now facing a 10% budget increase due to challenging and complex nature of hospital renovation work. The university this week is asking the Iowa Board of Regents to approve an increase for the project that would bring its total cost from $13.5 million to $15 million after four bids to build the upgraded center all came in all over budget. While the lowest was 20% over budget, the highest was nearly 30% above the expected cost, according to the UI. These high bids are believed to be the result of challenging and complex nature of this hospital renovation work, according to UIHC's cost increase request. For example, the work requires multiple construction phases, temporary construction work, and infection control to maintain the existing burn treatment center's operation. The UI healthcare construction is paid for out of hospital revenues, not state appropriations from the legislature. The burn center increase is another in a list of budget hikes requests the university has brought before the Board of Regents in recent years. Regents approved a 33% cost increase for UIHC's new North Liberty Hospital in 2022, raising the cost for the 469,000 square foot facility from $395 million to $525 million due to inflation and a workforce shortage. The university last year sought permission to triple its expense on new windows across its 14-story Stead Family Children's Hospital from $15 million to $45 million after realizing the problems were more widespread than first thought. And the Children's Hospital itself saw its total price tag swell from an original $270.8 million to nearly $450 million, including costs associated with various design changes, legal battles, and prematurely damaged windows. In further explaining its need to spend more on the burn unit center than when Regents approved its budget in November, UI officials said complex planning and construction work sequencing would be required to minimize any impact to other hospital areas. Substantial modifications to mechanical, electrical, plumbing and technology, medical gas, and life safety systems are also required. Built in 1992, the 32-year-old John Colleton Pavilion houses UIHC's burn treatment center. This 11,500-square-foot renovation would add burn inpatient rooms and a burn outpatient clinic with a dedicated entrance, exam rooms, a procedure room, waiting area, and other support spaces. For the inpatient area, the work would include hydrotherapy rooms, staff and office rooms, and aesthetic updates. If approved, the expansion and renovation is supposed to start this spring and wrap in spring of 2025. Aesthetic upgrades would begin and finish in early 2026. And also on the front page, legislative session ends after passing big changes. AEA overhaul, tax cuts, school security, all approved by Caleb McCullough. Des Moines. The 2024 Iowa legislative session ended Saturday when House lawmakers passed their final bills and adjourned for the year after a session marked by education policy, tax cuts, and other policies from the leading conservative majorities. As the session came to a close, Republicans praised the bold ideas and transformation undertaken during the session. Democrats argued the leading party failed to meet the needs of Iowans and instead served special interests. Here's a look at six major policies passed this session and what effect they will have in Iowans. Some of these bills have already been signed into law, while others are likely to become law in the coming weeks. AEA funding oversight changes. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, came into the session with an ambitious plan to reshape the 50-year-old area education agency system that provides special education and other support services to school districts in Iowa. It was one of the first bills Reynolds proposed in January, and it remained her top priority for more than 3 months until a vision far different from her first proposal was signed into law. Reynolds' bill was met with skepticism by House Republicans, who declined to advance it out of subcommittee, even after she offered an amendment to soften some of the changes. The final bill will keep AEAs as the primary provider of special education in the state. When it is fully implemented, schools will be required to spend 90% of their special education funding with the AEAs, while 10% will remain with the school district and can be spent elsewhere. I'm happy with what the bill ended up. Really, it was a phenomenal place to start, Reynolds told reporters in April. For media and other educational services provided by the AEAs, Iowa schools will eventually get all of the funding currently going to the agencies, and they can choose whether to contract with the AEA, receive services elsewhere, or use the money for other general fund purposes. The bill, House File 2612, also brings the oversight and administration of the AEAs under the State Department of Education. Democrats opposed the bill at every stage of the process, saying there was no need for fundamental changes to the AEAs. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, Democrat Windsor Heights, said she believes there will be lasting consequences from the law. Imagine what will happen next year, she said. So many unintended consequences here, and will really continue to hurt our rural communities especially. In rural Iowa, when you've got small districts, the AEAs provide those services that can't otherwise be afforded because you've got one child who needs them. Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican, New Hartford, said House Republicans worked to protect special education funding in what eventually became the final bill. He said lawmakers would continue to monitor to ensure the law is working as intended. There's a lot of things in the bill as well that schools are excited to have some opportunities to have some flexibility with some of these funds, he said. So look forward to seeing how that plays out. And I think the bill that we were able to put together will continue to deliver on those special ed services. The bill also increased the minimum pay for public school teachers in the state, requiring schools to pay teachers at least $50,000 by the 2025-26 school year. Teachers with at least 12 years of experience will be paid at least $62,000. Tax cuts, tax amendments. Iowa Republicans have rarely gone through a recent session without passing legislation to lower taxes, and this session was no different. House and Senate lawmakers passed a bill that will accelerate Iowa's movement towards imposing a flat income tax representing around $1 billion in additional tax cuts. The bill, Senate File 2442, will lower Iowans' income tax to a flat 3.8% in 2025 for all taxpayers, rather than a progressive tax system that imposes a higher rate on higher earners. The bill also tweaks last year's property tax overhaul that limits revenue growth for cities and counties and allows county supervisors to decide whether to keep or disband county compensation boards. Reynolds signaled support for the bill in a statement and touted Republicans' effort to lower taxes over the last 6 years. Iowa families live within their means every day, and there's no reason government can't do the same. Thanks to conservative budgeting and fiscal responsibility, Iowa is in a strong position to cut taxes and continue to invest in key priorities like housing, childcare, broadband, and more. While Democrat leaders opposed the bill, several Democrats in both chambers voted with Republicans to pass it. Democrats who opposed it said it gave a disproportionate windfall to Iowa's most wealthy, while giving low and middle-income families only minor relief. Republicans also gave first passage to two proposed constitutional amendments that would enshrine their tax-cutting agenda into the state constitution. One of the proposals would require Iowa to maintain a flat individual income tax. The second would require a two-thirds majority vote of the legislature to increase income taxes. Both proposals must be passed by a future General Assembly, which could be as early as next year, and must then be approved by a majority vote on a statewide ballot measure. If approved by voters, the amendments would be added to the state constitution. Illegal immigration. While several bills were considered to penalize people in Iowa who are not in the U.S. legally, lawmakers settled on a bill that would make illegal immigration a state crime in Iowa, mimicking a Texas law that has faced a lengthy court battle. In passing Senate File 2340, Republicans accused President Joe Biden of failing to secure the southern border and said states must act to address the record number of unlawful border crossings in recent years. The bill criminalizes illegal reentry, allowing Iowa law enforcement to arrest a person who is not in the U.S. legally and has previously been deported or denied entry. A judge could then issue a person an order to return to their country of origin as an alternative to criminal sentencing. The Iowa City-based immigrant rights group Escucha Mi Voz is planning demonstrations May 1st and July 1st to protest the law. The group has vowed to fight it in court. School security. The legislative session began just days after a school shooting rocked the town of Perry and led lawmakers to call for stronger school safety measures. A 17-year-old student shot and killed 11-year-old Amir Jalief and Perry High School principal Dan Marburger, who died 10 days later from injuries sustained in the shooting. Six others were wounded, and the shooter died of self-inflicted gunshot. The governing Republican majority did not call for any new gun control measures. They proposed bills to create a permitting process for school staff to carry guns and require school resource officers at some schools, and a separate bill to beef up safety infrastructure and allow schools to use professional development dollars to pay for firearms training for staff members. State law already allows school staff to carry guns if approved, but insurance companies have been hesitant to provide coverage to schools who allow staff to be armed. Republicans, who said armed staff could cut down on response times in active shooter scenarios, hope the new permitting process will increase insurers' concerns, will ease insurers' concerns. Time and math do not lie. The first 30 seconds in these scenarios are extremely critical, said Representative Phil Thompson, Republican Boone, during the floor debate on the bill. This bill does set a high standard for districts and staff that want to participate in this and go the extra mile to protect our kids. Democrats argued more guns on school campuses would not make schools safer, but would instead increase the risk of firearm injuries and deaths. They argued the training imposed by the bill was inadequate to prepare staff to respond to active shooters. Religious freedom. In strengthening legal protections for religious liberty, Iowa Republicans this year said they were safeguarding freedom from government intrusion. But Democrats warned the law could give people the right to discriminate under the cover of religious beliefs. Reynolds signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law during a closed-door reception hosted by the Christian conservative group The Family Leader. The bill, Senate File 2095, will apply the highest legal scrutiny to any government action that burdens religious belief, stating that an action that burdens religious liberty must further a compelling government interest and be the least restrictive means to further that interest. The law is in effect at the federal level and in more than 20 states around the country. In a statement when she signed the bill, Reynolds said religious rights have been under attack. Democrats raised concerns that the protections could be used to deny services to people based on their gender, marital status, or race. Republicans argued that this has not happened in other states where the law has been passed. Medicaid extension. Iowa will begin providing Medicaid coverage to new moms who qualify for up to 12 months, but fewer moms will qualify under the bill Reynolds proposed and the legislature passed this year. Senate File 2251 lowers Iowa's threshold for pregnant women to qualify for Medicaid from 375% to 215% of the federal poverty line, or around $44,000 for a single mom and $67,000 for a family of four. An estimated 1,700 women and infants will no longer qualify for the program each month. But those who do qualify will receive a full year of postpartum care instead of 60 days, taking advantage of an option made available to states and federal American Rescue Plan. Iowa is one of the last states that has not yet enacted the extension. From Iowa Today, Marion's new budget bumps staff pay, boosts infrastructure, mobile library, Central Plaza, among items on tap in fiscal 2025, by Marissa Payne, The Gazette. While Iowa communities grapple with property tax reform that state lawmakers passed last year, Marion's fiscal 2025 budget bumps staff pay and invests in infrastructure improvements. Overall, total city expenditures in fiscal 2025, which spans July 1 through June 30, 2025, are budgeted at $177.6 million. Marion is slated to generate about $150.3 million in revenue under a budget passed last week by the Marion City Council. The revenue and expenditure budgets include the general fund, which uses property tax dollars to fund entities such as parks and recreation, public safety, and community development, as well as other funds such as capital funds, the water department, and other enterprise funds. The city approved a $14.803 property tax rate, which is expected to generate an additional $2.1 million in revenue. The rate is down from the current $15.03. Under the new city levy rate, the owner of a house with an assessed value of $200,000 would see an approximately $1,372 annual city tax bill. This does not include other taxing authorities, such as for schools and Linn County government. The state-set residential rollback rate, the percent of a home's value that can be taxed, hit its lowest point since 1979, falling to 46.3%. That means residents' assessed home values would need to have risen more than 19.75% for homeowners to see an increase in the city portion of their property tax bill. After state lawmakers last year passed House File 718 with bipartisan support, the city's taxable valuation grew 9% and totaled $2.05 billion in 2023. Based on the legislation to keep tax bills down, however, the city captured only about 6% of that valuation growth. The bill set triggers to reduce the levy by certain amounts if valuation growth is 3% or more. In recent years, Marion has implemented a zero-based budget process to ensure greater scrutiny and more productive use of taxpayer dollars, according to the city. The adopted operating budget includes the following investments. The city will fill two vacant police officer positions that were left open last year so it could fund unplanned wage bumps to help Marion Police Department recruitment, an upgrade to a recently vacated administration position within the fire department also was included, which Finance Director Leanne Carey said will help with reporting and other fire initiatives. Second, with work underway on Marion's $7.3 million Central Plaza project to transform City Square with a new Central Plaza, project implementation also was included in the budget. The city in February kicked off the public portion of the capital campaign to raise $1.3 million and already has secured more than $850,000. Staffing for the $400,000 mobile library will allow the city to take books, technology, and other services directly to underserved areas and senior facilities, ensuring equity and maximizing the public impact of the library, Mayor Nick Abous-Assali previously said. This comes after the new Marion Public Library opened in November 2022. To maintain the competitive wages and benefits for city employees, the budget cover increases to the non-bargaining wage scale by 4% total, 2% as a cost of living boost, plus a 2% merit pay raise in July 2024. This recommendation is in line with the city's recently completed compensation study. Bargain increases for the city's union members also were included, as well as pay bumps recommended in the study for a part-time staff. Retirement costs fell for the Municipal Fire and Police Retirement System of Iowa, which provides pension benefits to Iowa's local public safety personnel. The employer contribution rate will drop from 22.98% in fiscal 2024 to 22.66% in fiscal 2025. Marion's capital improvement program included $21 million in streets and $20 million in sewer improvements. Funding for capital projects comes from the 1% local option sales tax, grants, general obligation bonds, and other pay-as-you-go funds. The city budgeted a total of $63.7 million on capital expenditures in fiscal 2025, including Indian Creek Trunk Sewer Segment 7 and 11. This joint project with the City of Cedar Rapids involves replacing and widening the main sewer line. It is a key to adding capacity for future growth, according to the city. Albernette Road Extension. This project received $7 million in federal funding and involves extending Albernette Road from Edinburgh Drive south across Indian Creek through Willow Park and along 2nd Street to 7th Avenue. This will ease traffic congestion on residential streets and along Central Avenue and 10th Street. Central Plaza, construction of a community gathering space with amenities and event space in Uptown. This is the result of a much more mature milestone-based series of actions that you all have worked against for well over a year, Councilmember Grant Harper said of the budget. Abu Asali said he appreciated the thoughtful planning that went into the budget. It's really a major step in our growing up process as a city, he said. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Paul Ortman, 88, of Lisbon, Iowa, passed away peacefully at home on Sunday, April 21st, 2024. Visitation 9:30 to 11 a.m. on Thursday, May 2nd, 2024 at St. John's Catholic Church, Mount Vernon. Memorial Mass will begin at 11 a.m. at the church. Burial 1 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd, 2024 at Lisbon Cemetery. Mary Disterhoff died on April 5th, 2024. She grew up in Lone Tree but spent the majority of her life in Iowa City. A funeral mass will be held on Friday, April 26th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Iowa City. Father Troy Richmond presiding. A light luncheon will follow. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Patrick's Catholic Church or Friends of the Iowa City Senior Center. Robert Brian Green, 77, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on April 21st, 2024 at Cottage Grove, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, April 26, 2024, St. Matthew Catholic Church, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Funeral Mass 11 a.m. Friday, April 26, 2024 at the church. Burial Greenwood Cemetery, Cedar Falls, Iowa at a later date. Geraldine Jerry Duravage, Cedar Rapids, 88, passed away on April 20th, 2024 at the Marion Home in Fort Dodge, Iowa. A visitation will be held at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church on Wednesday, April 24th, 2024 from 10 to 10:45 a.m., followed by a funeral service at 11 a.m. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 25th, 2025 at Oakshade Cemetery in Marion, Iowa. The family has chosen Bowman Funeral Home to care for their needs. Marilyn Elizabeth Worthen, 75, of Anamosa, went to be with her Lord and Savior Monday, April 15th, 2024. Graveside services will take place at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, 2024. Friends may call from 9 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, 2024 at Gosh Funeral Home in Anamosa. She will be laid to rest with her husband at Forest Chapel Cemetery. Please visit goshonline.com to share your thoughts, memories, and condolences with Marilyn's family. Vera Mehring. Heaven gained a special angel when Vera Frances Mehring, age 95, left this world on Saturday, April 20th, 2024. Visitation for Vera will take place on Sunday, April 28th, 2024 at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories Stateroom from 2 to 4 p.m. A memorial service for Vera will take place on Monday, April 29th, 2024, at 10 o'clock a.m. at All Saints Catholic Church, 720 29th Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52403, with Father John R. Flaherty officiating. Harry David Holland, Bloomfield, Indiana, 72, passed away April 19th, 2024. Visitation will be held April 25th from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Funeral Chapel of Powell and Deckard, 3000 East 3rd Street, Bloomington, Indiana. A pre-funeral visitation will take place at St. Charles Catholic Church in Bloomington, Indiana, from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., at which time a funeral mass will be celebrated. Burial with military rites will immediately follow at Clear Creek Cemetery, Bloomington, Indiana. Jack Ray Mully, 92, of Coralville, Iowa, passed away on Friday, April 19, 2024. A visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, April 27, 2024, at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. A memorial service will follow at 3 p.m. at the funeral home. A private family burial will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery at a later date. Memorials may be made to United Action for Youth or Iowa Free Medical Clinic. Elva Lee Herman, 85, died April 20, 2024, at West Ridge Care Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Funeral Mass will be Thursday, April 25, 2024, at 10:30 a.m., at the Holy Trinity Parish, St. Mary Catholic Church in Keota. Visitation 1 hour before the service. Burial at St. Elizabeth Cemetery in Harper. Arrangements, home, funeral home, Sigourney. Sophia Evelyn Lennick, 97, of Iowa City, passed peacefully at her home surrounded by family on Friday, April 19th. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. on Thursday, April 25th at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church, Iowa City, with Father Ed Fitzpatrick officiating. Burial will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery, Iowa City. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. at St. Wenceslaus prior to the service. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Iowa City Hospice and the Iowa City Catholic Worker Safe House and Shelter. William Hay Quinby, 92, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully in his sleep on April 20, 2024, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House after a week of family and friends surrounding and embracing him with love and friendship. Per Bill's wishes, there will be no funeral service, and his body has been donated to the University of Iowa Deeded Body Program, always a Hawkeye. A celebration of life will be scheduled at a later date to give the family an opportunity to say thank you to his many friends for a lifetime of wonderful memories. In lieu of flowers, donations are encouraged to the Community Free Medical Clinic, 947 14th Avenue Southeast, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House, Hiawatha, Iowa, or the Ark of East Central, Iowa, 680 2nd Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids. On the Insight page, lawmakers serve interest, not Iowans. It's the time of year when we praise the Almighty that the Iowa legislative session has ended. Now, I am finally aware most citizens of Iowa pay little to no attention to what happens under the Golden Dome in Des Moines. In November, less than 55% of registered Iowans vote even cast ballots for those who represented them. Low voter turnout has helped put some questionable folks in legislative seats. It also allows those same individuals to support some crazy bills that outside organizations come up with and hand deliver to Des Moines to assure they remain at the top of the pecking order. It will be the younger generation's battle to get back to some basic form of a democracy here to represent the will of the people of Iowa instead of special interests. Wonder why unemployment benefits paid to workers who have lost their jobs at no fault of their own are harder to obtain and keep between jobs? Special interest groups achieved that anti-worker legislation so businesses can now pay less in unemployment insurance tax. Confused about why your tax dollars now go to unregulated private schools? Thank the governor and Republicans who supported this legislation, along with special interest groups. These same groups passed a bill that determines what history lessons are now taught in Iowa. Perplexed why education has become underfunded for many years in this state, many believe that is by design to push education towards private for-pay schools. Wondering why one of the most dangerous rollbacks of child labor protections in decades was signed by the governor in 2023? Thanks, special interest groups. Why do local city and county governments have very little say in what happens in the local level now, including minimum wage and what contractors are awarded construction bids? Thank the governor and the majority of her party members, along with special interest groups once again. Curious why prison guards and staff are not considered public safety, and all public sector employees, including teachers, have had bargaining rights gutted? Thank our previous governor, who held a vendetta against unions. Pondering why the current governor wanted to eliminate the powers of the statewide elected auditor? He happens to be on the opposite side of the partisan aisle and actually wants to hold officials accountable for how they spend our money. Asking why workers' compensation for Iowans injured on the job was stripped down? Special interest group wanted it that way. Profits over people should be the current governor's battle cry. Many bills have been written by Iowa and out-of-state special interest groups that have already achieved these things or are working on achieving these things in all states. If you want to know what will be coming down the road in Iowa before a new session starts, simply pay attention to the playbook of other states. We are in a race to the bottom. We are deteriorating into a state that holds no value for working people and cares only about what special interest groups who have candidates weigh to an elected seat through campaign donations. Rick Doyle is executive director for the Hawkeye Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Guest column, Rick Moyle. Diseases destroyed lives before vaccines. I recently asked readers who remember the days before routine childhood immunizations to share their stories from that time. Doing so, I believe, is our best chance to convince those who remain unsure about vaccinations of their necessity. Deidre from Maryland was a pediatric nurse during the 1970s. She recalls caring for children devastated by diseases that are now vaccine preventable. They were dependent on tube feedings and having intractable seizures, she wrote. The dean of her nursing school was wheelchair-bound from contracting polio as a student nurse. She also remembers learning that there were special college scholarships to encourage students to major in audiology because there were so many kids who had lost hearing as a lasting consequence of contagious illnesses. The ultimate irony of the success of childhood immunizations is people under 60 have no memory of the lifelong disabilities children and adults had as a result of these diseases, she shared. Peg from Massachusetts also urged people to consider the consequences to babies born to women who contracted the diseases during pregnancy. As a pediatric audiologist, I have seen hundreds of cases of deafness, blindness, and cognitive impairment in children whose mothers contracted rubella during pregnancy, she wrote. These cases came to a near standstill after the widespread use of the measles, mumps, rubella MMR vaccine. Susan from Arizona is a polio survivor. She contracted the virus in 1946, 9 years before the first polio vaccines were made available. She recalls that there were children in hospital wards who eventually stopped crying after repeated pleas to see their parents could not be met. Parents climbed on ladders outside hospitals to try to get glimpses of their children. She herself was an iron lung baby. Like many others, her respiratory muscles were paralyzed and she depended on a machine to breathe. In her 20s, she developed post-polio syndrome. In total, she has had 5 surgeries for nerve impingement. Part of her hip was transplanted on her ankle. Pain and fatigue have always been a part of my life, she told me. Now retired from her career as a nurse educator, Susan describes her mother as being shamed, blamed, and marginalized because of her daughter's illness. On the day her mother died, she learned that her mother was haunted by the guilt that she was the one who gave her daughter polio. Ruth from Virginia also shared a moving story about a family member. Her little sister Beth, who was barely a year and a half old when she contracted measles in 1949, Ruth believes her sister was exposed to the virus at the doctor's office. One night when my brother and I were sleeping, our parents brought her to the hospital, she wrote. Either that night or the next, she died. I have carried that grief around with me ever since, Ruth wrote. I'm now 84 years old. It is jarring every time she hears anti-vaccine comments. These individuals, she believes, are ignoring the impacts on the family when a child dies. To go through this grief before vaccines were available was a terrible tragedy. It is many times worse now that we have the tools to avert such suffering and death. Lena S. Wynn is professor at George Washington University's Milken Institute School of Public Health. Community letters. Out-of-place blooms help our environment. Do you have a plant out of place in your lawn? Those out-of-place pops of color in our yards have gotten a bad reputation over the past 40 years. But not to everyone in Iowa City. A lot of folks allow those plants in place such as our city parks, our school grounds, and residential yards. Colorful flowers in the grass show that toxic chemicals are not being sprayed there. Kids can frolic and pets can roll in such lawns without exposure to cancer-linked chemicals such as glyphosate. Plants out of place provide food for early pollinating insects, bees, and butterflies. Such lawns help reduce the stormwater cleanup costs that we all end up paying for. Weed-killing chemicals end up in our stormwater and streams. Iowa Department of Natural Resources understands the damage these chemicals have on natural water systems. DNR encourages environmentally friendly lawn care through cost-share programs administered by cities and counties across the state. Rebate programs such as stormwater cost-share, soil health, and your best lawn help homeowners get greener lawns using fewer chemicals. Enter a lawn culture that encourages appreciation of diverse lawns to protect child health, water quality, pets, pollinators, and biodiversity. Linda Quinn, Iowa City. And a few more obituaries. Joan Marie McKellick Miller, 81, of Ely, Iowa, passed away Friday, April 19, 2024, at her home. No services will be held, and a private interment will take place at St. John's Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cedar Rapids, assisted the family. Barbara Jean Elson, age 94, met her Lord and Savior Sunday, April 21st, in St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Celebration of Life services will be held Thursday, April 25th at 11 a.m. at Anchor Bible Church with Pastor Andrew Happ officiating. Visitation will precede the service starting at 9:30 a.m. The burial will be at the Ames Municipal Cemetery Friday, April 26th at 10:30 a.m. with a graveside service. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point is assisting the family. Gary Leroy Eagleson, 81, died Friday, April 12, 2024 at UIHC. A celebration of life will be held at the Community Center, Olin City Park, Olin, Iowa, 4 to 7 p.m. on April 26, 2024. Placement in Little Salamone River Cemetery at a later date. Stephanie Beth Clark, 50, of Mount Vernon, passed away Tuesday, April 16, 2024 at Mechanicsville Specialty Care. Friends and family will gather from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, April 25, 2024 at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Mount Vernon. In sports, events of the area interest, high school track, Regina at Xavier Invitational, 4:30 p.m., Marion at Vinton-Shelsburg Invitational, 4:15 p.m. Girls soccer, Jefferson at Xavier, 4:15 p.m., Prairie at Liberty, 4:15 p.m., Kennedy at City High, 4:15 p.m., Washington at Iowa City West, 6:45 p.m., Western Dubuque at Linmar, 7:30 p.m. Boys soccer, Xavier at Jefferson, 4:15 p.m., Liberty at Prairie, 7 p.m., City High at Kennedy Co., 7:30 p.m., Iowa City West at Washington, Kingston Stadium, 7:30 p.m., Lynn Mar at Western Dubuque, 7 p.m., Girls Tennis, Xavier at Jefferson, 4 p.m., Liberty at Kennedy, 4 p.m., City High at Washington, 4 p.m., Western Dubuque at Lynn Mar, 4 p.m., Grinnell at Marion, 4 p.m., Dubuque-Wallert at Prairie, 4 p.m., and Boys Tennis, Jefferson at Xavier, 4 p.m., Washington at City High, 4 p.m., Kennedy at Liberty, 4 p.m., Lynn Mar at Western Dubuque, 4 p.m., Prairie at Dubuque-Wallert, 4 p.m., Marion-Grinnell, 4 p.m. Boys Golf, Regina at West Liberty Tournament, West Liberty CC Noon, and Girls Golf, that was Monday at the Iowa City Invitational at Finkbein Golf Course. Number one team, Iowa City Liberty, 390. Number two, Iowa City High, 402. And number three, Iowa City West, 435. The top five individuals, Isabella Peterson, Iowa City Liberty, 73. Haley Nelson, Iowa City High, 83. And number three, Ty Hannah Kronk, Iowa City High. And Lila Bowman, Iowa City Liberty, 102. Number five, Tully Campion, Iowa City High, 105. Iowa City High, 402. Nelson, 83. Kronk, 102. Campion, 105. Emery Angelic, 112. At Winthrop, Buffalo Creek Golf Course, par 35. Lisbon, 183. East Buchanan, 204. Medalist Kaylee Kelchin, 41. At Central City, Meadowview Golf Course, par 36. For team scores, number one, Central City, 228. Number two, Midland, 235. Number three, Springville, 236. Medalist Breton Decker, 42. In boys golf, Monday at Central City, Meadowview teams, number one, Springville, 183. Number two, Central City, 189. Number three, Midland, 201. Medalist Bo Decker, 36. At Guttenberg Golf Course, par 36. Clayton Ridge, 177. West Central, 205. Medalist Brennan Miller, 42. In boys tennis, Iowa Boys Tennis Coaches Poll Rankings, Class 2A, number one, Waukee Northwest, number two, Lynn Mar, three, Pleasant Valley, number four, Iowa City West, number five, Mason City, number six, Cedar Rapids, Washington, seven, West Des Moines Valley, eight, West Des Moines Dowling, number nine, Bettendorf, and number 10, Cedar Falls. In Class 1A, Dubuque-Wallert was number one, number two, Cedar Rapids Xavier, number three, Pella, number four, North Polk, number five, Waverly-Shell Rock, six, Boone, seven, Decorah, eight, Sergeant Bluff-Luton, number nine, Glenwood, and 10, Shenandoah. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. You can access a recording of today's reading on your website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.